I'm delighted now to welcome back to the show Stephen Kotler. He's co-author of the book Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a book basically about the world, standard of living in the world, how to make it better, how to think about things like food and water and shelter and energy and technology in the next pretty short time frame, right? What, 20 years or so?
20 to 30 years.
How did this book come about?
The book came about for me as I had finished my previous book, Small Furry Prayer, and I had been thinking a lot about issues of biodiversity and ecosystem services and how do you protect ecosystem services and things along those lines. And it started, I had been doing a lot of deep research into food systems. If you want to protect biodiversity, you have to free up a lot of land, mega linkages, you have to join national parks together with migration corridors and do things like that. It's just about the only thing you can kind of do, and that means we need land. And so I was, how do we get agriculture and ranching off the land technologically? Is it possible? So I started looking at in vitro meat, which is the idea of growing steak from stem cells. And I was looking at vertical farming, which is the idea of moving farms from agricultural lands to the inside of skyscrapers, which for various reasons is a really, you know, the average foodstuff travels 1,500 miles. That is
both of which things that you just said, in vitro meat and vertical farms, I mean, they make most people's brains explode even thinking about them.
They do. A lot of these technologies, the crazy thing about them is, you know, there's a lot of very future-forward technologies in this book, but they're all here today. First vertical farms are being built right now. In vitro meat, they've already pulled it off. It's really a question of scaling it up.
So it's basically making meat without having an animal that you killed in the first place?
Growing meat from stem cells, yeah. And, I mean, by the way, it's not a new idea. Winston Churchill had the idea years and years and years ago. So it's these aren't new ideas, but they are, you know, tissue engineering has come so far in recent years. This is really, really feasible. Anyways, I was looking at all these technologies, really looking into food and really looking into water issues, and I was shocked, actually, by what I found. You know, I had really kind of bought into a lot of the kind of media doom and gloom and was part of that, did a lot of, you know, a lot of work around this. But when I started diving deeper, I realized, A, I was wrong on a lot of things that I thought I'd been right on. And at kind of this point in time that I, you know, reached all these realizations, Peter Diamandis, who's my co-author, who I've known for 15 years, maybe 12 years, I guess, called me and asked me if I wanted to work on this project with him. And he kind of outlined his ideas, and he seemed to I had like a third of a book kind of built around the biodiversity ideas. He had a little more than that, but you put them together and, you know, it was two-thirds, maybe three-quarters of a book, and there was obviously some new information in the book, some research that we did along the way, stuff we didn't know about. But that's kind of where it came from.
And so one of the things that you're looking at and that is central to understanding what's going on around us is the fact that we live in a world where we are using resources unsustainably and our population is growing, which will lead to a gloom and doom scenario unless we do something differently. And this book is about all the different things that we can do.
The book is, I mean, at its core, it's about four emerging forces that give us the potential to significantly raise global standards of living over the next 20 to 30 years. That's at its core. Along the way, as it turns out, because population is one of those massively intractable problems, like preserving ecosystem services or staving off the sixth great extinction, that is truly terrifying. And I'm a guy who was a very big kind of zero population growth advocate. Again, this was another thing that I realized I was very wrong about. What I didn't realize is how tightly correlated population growth was to health and economics. And when I started looking at the numbers and started to realize that, you know, the greatest thing we can possibly do to lower population is raise global standards of living.
And it's sort of counterintuitive because you think that if you have a population where there is a high mortality rate, that population won't be growing as fast. But it seems to be the opposite.
It's totally the opposite. And it's because essentially when there's high child mortality, people have replacement births. And it's actually a slightly sadder thing. But the truth of the matter is, in most of the developing world right now, people want three boys. And the reason they want three boys is because one is going to probably die, one needs to go to college and work real hard, to break the poverty cycle, and one has to support the parents and the person going to college. So since it's 50-50 split, boy-girl, if you want three boys, you're probably going to have six kids. So people have replacement personnel and all this sort of thing, and it really drives population numbers up. If you improve childhood mortality, if you lower those numbers, if you lower the number of kids who are dying, and the easiest way to do this, by the way, is to provide fresh, clean water to the world. Really, it truly is. Population drops precipitously.
And you say some of the same things that Nicholas Kristof says, which is the key to really dropping population is also associated with, and these things are intertwined, the education of women and girls.
Education of women and girls, yeah. I mean, I think Nicholas would argue that educating women and girls is the number one thing you can do to lower population. I would argue that providing clean, fresh water to the world is the number one thing you can do to lower population. But either or, liberate women, provide information and access to contraception and information about and clean water.
And even thought that maybe the person who will go to college would be the girl.
It would be nice, right?
There is, in your book, you talk about a pyramid, and on the lowest level of the pyramid is food, water, and shelter, and that sort of goes up from there. Okay, let's talk about water, since we've been talking about water. How do you provide clean water in a place where, I mean, people talk about water as being sort of the next oil in terms of being that over which we fight?
Well, you have to stop and back up and realize that, you know, we live on a water planet. The Earth is 70% water. 97.5% of it is salt water. 2% is locked up in polar ice caps, and we are arguing we are arguing about 0.5%. But a desalination technology that can free up 0.005% more seawater is all we need. And those technologies exist. Dean Kamen, who's one of the great maverick inventors of all time, has created, you know, a technology called the slingshot. It takes anything, salt water, latrine water, the dirtiest water you can imagine, and for less than a penny a liter produces absolutely clean, fresh, and actually injectable grade water. This technology is ready now. Coca-Cola, by the way, this was just announced this week. Coca-Cola had been doing field trials with it at a low level. They're now going to ramp it up to hundreds and hundreds of machines. And if this goes forward and it works, they're going to distribute it and maintain it with their giant network.
What's in it for them?
They get to solve the world's water problems. In all honesty, I mean, I really do think I know you're going to argue with me about this, but I do think you're seeing much more corporate responsibility these days than we've ever seen before. Is it what we need? I'm not saying it's the level that we need, but I do think we're seeing significantly more responsibility.
One of the things that was surprising to me was that I hadn't heard of this Cayman's water purification. It came from the problem that people who are on dialysis need absolutely pure water, and so he, through a lot of trial and error, invented this machine that basically takes tap water and makes it into water that's pure enough for dialysis, and then found out that you could even take gray water and make it into pure water. Why doesn't every Santa Fean have one in their house?
Well, the main reason is because he's been producing them one at a time, right? So the first one, I think, I don't know how much the first one cost, but he got the cost down to $200,000, and then he got it down to $100,000 per unit, and then he got it down to $60,000, and I don't know where it is now, but it's really about mass production. We need to be producing lots of these things to bring them to scale, but it does. That's why Coca-Cola is the big deal. That's what matters, is it brings these things to scale and makes them affordable for everybody.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler. Let's talk about food. And this is something that we started off with, this idea of hydroponic farming, the idea of vertical farming. Is that more productive? Does it just take up less space? What's so great about that?
It can be significantly more productive. Depending on whose design you follow and which way, and there are estimates, but 80% less water, 70% less water. I mean, 70% of the water the planet, I think that number is right. I could be wrong. I don't have the book open in front of me. Is used for agriculture. Massive amounts of water goes to agriculture. So just moving our farms indoors into vertical farms, if it's saving 80% of our water, that's a massive savings. That's a massive amount of water it frees up.
Well, it doesn't save 80% of it. We're still using it for agriculture, just at a lower rate.
Well, we're using it at a much lower rate, and most of it gets recycled within the building.
Right.
So it comes, I mean, obviously you're going to lose stuff in your foodstuffs, but it really closes the loop on a lot of the stuff. Closes the loop on energy, closes the loop on soil, significantly better for the environment. Food miles go away, so, you know, saves a tremendous amount on gas. It also, by the way, it ups significantly raises the nutritional impact of food, right? Food, the farther it gets away, it goes away from the place it was grown, the more days out you eat it, the less nutrition it has in it.
Well, so, and we have degraded soils, which are also giving us less nutrition.
So these technologies, and hydroponics and aeroponics, which is, hydroponics is growing plants in a moisture-rich solution, and aeroponics is doing it in mist, basically. Aeroponics is significantly higher in terms of its water savings than hydroponics. So it closes the loop on a lot of these things.
And presumably you wouldn't need pesticides either if there were not a lot of insects in the building.
They want to grow it in, and they're doing this, by the way, in Japan right now. They have these giant, they call them plant warehouses. They're not vertical farms, they're horizontal farms in a sense, but they're growing food in clean rooms. So you need zero pesticides.
Yeah. The book is called Abundance, and in your book you talk about the four forces for abundance. What are those four forces?
Well, the first is exponentially growing technology. And this is the idea that essentially, let's start at the simple one. The example most people are familiar with is Moore's Law. Moore's Law basically says that every 12 to 24 months, your computer gets twice as fast for the same price, right? Now, this has been going on since Gordon Moore first observed it in 1965. It's almost 50 years that this has been happening. This is known as exponential growth.
Is there any kind of physical limit to that?
Well, the funny thing about all this, and let me come back to that question in half a second. What a lot of scientists, Ray Kurzweil among others, have figured out is that once a technology becomes information-based, it tends to jump on an exponential growth curve, right? And exponential growth is really, really, really deceptive. But in computers, it's the reason why, you know, an $8 million supercomputer from the 1970s that filled a room now sits in your pocket and costs less than $200, right? Well, this same kind of growth is showing up in artificial intelligence and robotics and nanotechnology, synthetic biology, molecular manufacturing, cloud computing, and dozens of other very, very, very potent technologies. In fact, biology is advancing so quickly, it's moving five times as fast as Moore's Law. Now, to answer your previous question, is there a limit? For a very long time, people kind of kept expecting Moore's Law to grind out, that this was a market trend, sooner or later it was going to go away. Turns out, the scientists and researchers now know that if you look, Moore's Law is not the first exponential paradigm, it's the fifth that's happened since the information age has kind of sort of begun. And it's happened through wartime, through depression, through disease, through pandemics. It's on and on. It's persisted for the whole of the 20th century. So while these are supposed to be market trends, scientists now talk about them as having the force of a natural law. Will they at an end at some point? Perhaps. A lot of these things do have an end. But what scientists have also figured out is usually when one of these kind of paradigm-shifting technologies, when the exponential trend peters out, we have a new paradigm. For example, vacuum tubes were replaced by silicon in the computer and takes over for that, and the exponential trend continues. So the first of our forces, and it kind of underpins everything else we're talking about, is the exponential growth rate of technology. The next force is the newfound power of the DIY innovator, the do-it-yourself innovator. For the first time in history, DIY innovators, small groups or people or individuals, have the same power as large corporations and governments. This has never happened before. We give a number of examples in the book. An easy one is my co-writer, Peter Diamandis, runs the XPRIZE Foundation. The first XPRIZE was won by a man named Burt Rutan, sent a man into space. It took NASA $300 billion to do this, right? And thousands of engineers. Burt Rutan did it with $26 million and a team of 20 engineers, right? This is just one example. I'll give you another random example. MIT runs a synthetic biology competition called the iGEM competition, aimed at high school and college students. In 2008, the winner of the iGEM competition was a team of high school and college students from Slovenia, which is, by the way, not a country known for a biotech industry, right? and they created a real-world vaccine for the most common virus that causes ulcers. So this is a giant biopharmaceutical product created by high school kids, right, in a lab working with almost no money. These kinds of revolutions are going on right and left, and the DIY innovator can really, for the first time in history, go after what we call grand challenges, really big world-changing problems.
It's interesting because both of these examples you give are people who have maybe not, in one case there was money, in the other case there was very little, but still groups surrounded by some kind of institutional or institutional support, education, things like that.
Well, I mean, I happen to give a DIY bio example that came out of MIT, the iGEM competition, but you have DIY bio shops in sprouting up in cities all over the world. These are just open source communities. I'll give you another kind of random example. Have you heard of Foldit?
Yeah.
Okay. So Foldit is about protein folding, right? It's a game. It comes out at the University of Washington, and they find out that protein folding used to be a supercomputer kind of problem, right? And it turns out that the human pattern recognition system is better at it than supercomputers are. So they've put out this game, and people are going home after work, and they're folding proteins. Do you know who's best in the world at folding proteins?
Was it carpenters and graphic designers and stuff like that?
The world champion at protein folding is a woman who is an executive. She's English. She's an executive assistant at a treatment facility during the day. She goes home at night, and she is the world's greatest protein folder. And these folded proteins, by the way, are leading to major medical breakthroughs, right? So this is kind of the newfound power of the DIY inventor right now. The next force that we talk about is the techno-philanthropist. This is the new kind of breed philanthropists. These are people like Bill Gates and Jeff Skoll, people who reinvented industries before the age of 35, and they never really, because they did that, they never really lost their taste for the big and bold, and they're now taking these enormous sums of money. In some cases, these people have the wealth of nation states, obviously, and they're using it to go after the world's grand challenges. So you have Bill Gates crusading for vaccines and against malaria, and Jeff Skoll, who is going after pandemics and nuclear proliferation, the Omidars, who are bringing electricity to the developing world. And this list goes on and on and on. They're really, 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 really doing amazing and interesting things for the first time kind of ever. And, you know, used to be robber barons. They made a lot of money. They wanted to build buildings in their honor. And they also kind of, the robber barons were a little different. It was, I write the check and I'm done. But this new breed is kind of like, I write the check and I'm just beginning. This is my way of getting started.
Making the comparison to robber barons isn't exactly going to win you a lot of converts because they did so much harm.
They did a lot of harm, but they also did massive amounts of good, right? They did. I mean, you can say what you want about robber baron greed, and it was severe, but they also invented modern philanthropy.
Right, and one way of looking at modern philanthropy is that the wealthiest class throws a few crumbs out to everybody else.
I agree that modern philanthropy is broken, and I mean, the greatest news about the techno-philanthropist is that they wanted to do things differently, right? Their whole point was, let's apply best business practices to philanthropy. This top-down model, you know, obviously it's broken. The numbers, the amount of kind of top-down aid we've thrown in the developing world over the past 3 or 4 decades is staggering, and the effect it's had is minuscule. That is starting to change because of this new breed philanthropy. And finally, our last force, which is what I'm the most excited about, we call this the rising billion, which is literally the poorest people on Earth. So over the past 20 years, the so-called bottom of the pyramid has started to emerge as a viable market force. A lot of companies have started to figure out how to do business at what they call the bottom of the pyramid, and that's starting to have an effect. But what's really exciting is right now we live in a planet where there's roughly 7 billion people. 2 billion people are online right now, connected to the Internet. By 2020, that number is going to jump to 5 billion. That means we get 3 billion new minds coming online for the very first time. These are people we've never had access to their brains before, their thoughts before, their thinking, what they want, what they desire, what they're going to build for themselves and us is absolutely revolutionary. It's an astounding idea. Think about this for a second. A Maasai warrior in the middle of Kenya right now on a cell phone has better access to information and communication than President Reagan did 25 years ago.
Right.
If they're on a smartphone with access to Google, they have better access to information and communication than President Clinton did 15 years ago. They are clearly living in a world of information and communication abundance, and it's only going to get better. One of the things that's happened, and this is, most people don't know this, and it blows my mind, right now there are more content creators in the developing world than in the developed. One of the reasons why Hollywood, who had a hegemony on entertainment for over 100 years, is no longer top of the mountain, is because it's coming out of the developing world for the first time ever.
Well, you have a section in your book in which you talk about how many hours of film come out of Hollywood and how many hours of film come out of YouTube, and YouTube equals Hollywood within, what, a week or two?
Oh, I actually think it's... It may be 10 minutes. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's a ridiculous reduction at this point.
Right, and what I was going to ask you was how much of that, not that Hollywood movies are the greatest thing ever, but if you look at YouTube at random, three quarters of it is like Dachshund chasing a ball and somebody giggling in the background.
It's true. I didn't say it was high quality content, but then again, I mean, you know, has Hollywood, do they consistently give us high quality content? I mean, you know, is it better or worse? I think we're at the front end of this revolution, and you're trying to compare, you know, Hollywood at 100 years to kind of figure out how to produce, you know, the product that we get now, and YouTube has been around for less than five.
Well, I guess the question is, does quantity equal quality in any way? Okay, maybe not. So you've got 5 billion people online. That's a lot of energy to harness, but what are you trying to do? How are you trying to harness it? What does that 5 billion people online do for the world, for each other, for themselves?
Well, I think one of the really interesting things that you're going to see is a lot of the technologies that we discuss, they can't really be deployed here in the first world. There's just too many regulations in the way. There's too much government in the way. And governments are not nimble enough right now to adapt to the growth rate of exponentially growing technology. So I think what you're going to see, especially in some of the kind of more environmentally friendly technologies, I think these things are going to get developed in the developing world. And you're going to see kind of trickle up economics. And they'll trickle up out of the developing world into the developed. And I think that's the only way you can kind of move the needle on some of these things. And the great example here is solar, which in America, in California, it should be competitive in a couple of years, but it still needs subsidies to be competitive. But right now in India, solar is half the price of coal. It's 50% cheaper than coal in India right now. So obviously, it's on a huge growth curve in India, and we could see things developing there that end up coming here.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler. What are some other examples of technologies that you are seeing coming up in the third world that could actually diffuse from developing countries to the United States?
Well, another difficult example, and this is fairly controversial, but, well, I mean, one of the less controversial ones is we're seeing kind of, if you look at, for example, genetically engineered crops in America, most of these things are still top-down crops owned by major corporations, and they serve an herbicide function, basically, pesticides and herbicides. What we're seeing in the developing world are things like golden rice, which is nutritionally packed rice, which, you know, could improve the lives of a billion people, or Biocassava Plus, which takes one of the world's kind of fundamental staple crops, packs it with a whole bunch of vitamins, preserves it for a couple of weeks rather than a couple of hours. These are technologies that are showing up in the developing world. I also think there's really exciting, you know, we talk a lot, I mean, there's a lot of technology in here, but there's a lot of kind of low-tech technologies, especially food technologies, agroecological technologies that are being developed in the developing world. I talk about the push-pull system, which is a kind of an intercropping system being developed to farm maize in Africa that's producing astounding results, really upping food supplies and productivity and whatnot. And it's just, you know, this is something that is fundamental there, it's being developed there, but these are better agricultural practices that I think are going to start getting exported into the first world.
I think it's also important to give that example because if you have a village in Africa, they're not going to build a hydroponic skyscraper.
Of course not. Of course not. One of the things about, you know, the technologies that we look at, and one of the reasons we wrote this book, is oddly, if you start talking to a lot of the experts in these fields, they know their field really, really well, but they very rarely know what's going on right next door. You know, I remember, and I'm not going to name names, but I was on the phone with one of the world's leading experts about water, and he was talking about how, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, it doesn't matter what we do for them. They're never going to have enough water, and there's going to be huge migration problems and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, okay, but, you know, what about low-grade vertical farms that move the save water and move the food to where the people are? And he had never heard of the technology. And I started listing technologies that are just in all the fields, and he had heard of none of them. And I said, well, how can you be an expert if you have no idea what's actually going on in every other field besides your little tiny nook, and yet you're standing in your little tiny nook saying the world's running out of water, we're running out of water, but you don't know anything that's going on just outside of it.
To save water.
To save water. And we found this over and over and over again. So one of the things about abundance is we try to blend all these things together so people get a holistic look at all these things and how they could work together.
Well, another part that plays into what you're talking about is education and how education has traditionally been that really puts an emphasis on math and science but not on the arts and creativity is exactly the opposite of what we need right now.
A lot of people say it's exactly the opposite of what we need right now. But one thing for sure at this point is between the Khan Academy, Stanford now has a lot of their classes online. MIT has a ton of their classes online. You can essentially go K through college for free online. So that means that Maasai Warrior, we were talking about earlier, if he's got a smartphone, he now has access to some of the highest quality education around. Now, it's true that a lot of people, and myself included, by the way, Khan Academy is great if you learn kind of in a top-down way, you know, microscopic to macroscopic, which is the way that kind of traditional industrialized education works. I'm not that kind of a thinker. You know, and that's difficult for me. But there's all kinds of video games, for example, have been proven extremely effective at teaching people various things through tangential learning.
How to steal cars in Miami.
How to steal cars in Miami and how to shoot up bad guys and things along those lines. No, there's all kinds of great educational games out there, and they're only getting better and better and better and better. I mean, you know, the first generation of educational games were kind of stupid and kind of turned everybody off, but the work didn't stop, right? Really new and exciting things are coming, and they teach people in really innovative ways. So if you can start blending the video games with maybe some of the stuff that the Khan Academy is coming up with, you're looking at the front end of an education revolution that we sorely need because we're running out of teachers and we can't afford the infrastructure and something's got to give. And on top of it, as you pointed out, the industrial model of education, which privileges the math and the sciences and doesn't privilege creativity, is not what we need in the 21st century.
As you're talking and as I was reading this book, I do find myself thinking about, I mean, if you kind of outsource all your education to online education, it's not just about information, it's about relationships. It's about the relationship you have with your teacher. It's about learning all sorts of discipline and interpersonal skills and things like that from your teachers, if you have good teachers. But I'll tell you what, and I'm sure you have this experience too, those few good teachers that you had in your life, you remember what they taught you far more than you remember the information that you learned along the way.
Well, one of the things that's happening, and this is happening with the Khan Academy, and this is happening with a bunch of different programs, is we're realizing the internet, the computer, can actually deliver the information as a general rule better than the teacher. What the teacher can do is coach. They can give positive feedback. They can be your friend. They also, you know, in Sugata Mitra did a whole bunch of experiments with learning where he basically set up computers in slums and left them for kids to see what they could teach themselves. And after a lot of trial and error and a lot of work, he's discovered that the very best learning system he can come up with is a bench with an internet terminal for kids and a grandmother to coach them. A grandmother doesn't have to know anything. She just has to be able to say, good job, keep going, tell me something new. But the four kids together trade ideas back and forth. They argue, they discuss, they learn much better than one kid. So he's coming up with something called minimally invasive education, where they're literally just like computer terminals hooked up to, you know, what he calls the granny crowd. He's literally recruited grandmothers in England to serve as coaches for four kids who come in and work on a computer terminal, and the grandmothers once a week, coach them along, and there's no real teachers involved.
But what about the selection of the information? In other words, deciding what the subject is for the day, for example.
Well, I mean, a lot of it is, again, it's very, very bottom up. This kind of command control education system where you say you have to learn all this, that was important when we had fact-based education, when you know your intelligence was measured by how much facts you can cram into your head. That generation is pretty much gone. Google gives you instant access to facts. You don't need those facts anymore.
And I mean, to all sorts of information, some of which isn't true.
Which is not true at all. My own Wikipedia page attests to that. No, I think that's really true.
I mean, there's a total lack of wisdom in this model, I guess is what I'm saying. And that is not a commodity, but it is one of the basic things about being human.
I'm sorry, there's a lack of wisdom in which model?
In the model that says anything you need to know, you can find out in Google.
Well, but let's invert it, right? The current model for education, the one that you're sort of defending accidentally here, is industrialized education. It basically says every student is the same, and we're going to teach them the same way, and they're going to have to learn the exact same thing, and it's cookie cutter. And one of the reasons that education fails is because kids are not all the same. They're totally different. Everybody's an individual learner. And this is, by the way, where we are right now. Within, you know, we're moving rapidly towards the point where we're going to have artificial intelligence, AI-based learning systems that are customized to each individual learner, right? So everybody will have an individual kind of porthole into the cloud where there'll be an educational AI, and you'll get your education custom, you know, suited for who you are. What we haven't figured out, and what's where it starts to get really interesting, and people are starting to do this now, and I think it's going to be really neat to see, is, you know, you can go get your Khan Academy education, you can watch all your Khan Academy videos, and you could take graduate classes at Stanford online for free, but it doesn't mean anything, because right now you can't get a diploma. They haven't figured out how to test it, right? Or how to standardize it, and it doesn't. Now, this is starting to change, but once they solve that, then the kind of traditional education system as we know it starts to crumble, and we see what's going to bubble up and emerge organically. That'll be really interesting.
And it'll be interesting to see the way it plays out, not only in third world countries and the places that you're talking about, but also in places like New Mexico, where we talk endlessly about the fact that half of the third graders in this, or some percentage of the third graders in the state can't read.
Yeah. I think it's going to make a huge difference in first world education as well. I think this is going to happen globally all at once.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler. Another place where tremendous technological revolutions are happening is in the field of health. And again, I mean, my mind is semi-boggling about all the stuff you were just saying about education. And now when we talk about health, there's an equally wild revolution going on.
It's actually both education and health are coming from the same point, right? It's artificial intelligence. But health is amazing. Let me give you an example. Everybody kind of remembers Jeopardy. Watson was the supercomputer that beat humans on Jeopardy. And the reason that was a big deal is because to do that, Watson needed to understand natural language, how people speak. Now, obviously, having a supercomputer that can play game shows isn't all that exciting to health. But what they did after, you know, they were done winning Jeopardy is they sent Watson to medical school. So the goal is basically to produce a supercomputer that can diagnose illness better than a board-certified doctor. So that is, you know, that supercomputer is going to be up in the cloud, accessible to everybody. Now, my co-writer, Peter Diamandis, just launched, and this is only one example of this technology, but he just launched the Qualcomm Tricorder X Prize. The Tricorder, maybe you remember the term, it was from Star Trek. It was the scanner that Bones had, and he waved it over people. It was a diagnostic technology. Well, the Qualcomm Tricorder X Prize goes to the Tricorder is basically a cell phone sized device that you can spit on, put a drop of blood on it or a drop of urine, and it uses a lab on a chip technology to analyze that, uploads that information to the cloud, feeds it to the AI, and suddenly you have a diagnostic technology for pennies on the dollar, or if not free, that accessible to anybody, that you know can transform medicine. Suddenly, if you're in the developing world and you don't have access to doctors for miles around, and you wake up in the middle of the night and your child is sick, or that happens here in the first world, you cough on your cell phone And seconds later, you know if it's time to go to the emergency room or, you know, if you can go back to bed. This is a revolution.
Does it also, for example, if you're not feeling well because it turns out you're just really stressed out, does it understand that too? In other words, does it understand the psychological dimension?
Not that I know of, but it is interesting. There's a lot of, you know, another technology that's on one of these exponential growth curves is sensors. And there's a big kind of biosensor movement, right? The quantified self movement is all about kind of measuring individual characteristics and things like that. So on a certain level, you know, while the tricorder doesn't get us there, some of the quantified self stuff, you know, perhaps might.
So all of these ideas are... many of them were new to me, some of them weren't, and certainly the problems that we're talking about and facing, lack of biodiversity and extinction and things about water supply, population, all that, are familiar probably to many of our listeners. One of the things that you talk about in the book is the pervasiveness of a kind of doom and gloom, I guess you would call it, set of fears that so many of us carry around. What's going on with that?
Well, this is not to say that we're not facing astounding problems right now, because obviously we are. We are up against some serious, serious challenges right now. But there's a couple things to point out. First of all, we're jumping up and down and we're saying the world is coming to an end. And I'll get to the reason why we do that in a second, but you have to kind of look at where we are in the past 100 years, for example. Child mortality has dropped by 90%, maternal mortality by 99%. Our lifespan has doubled. Groceries have, since the 1870s, have decreased in price 13-fold. Income, you know, adjusted for inflation, has tripled over the past century. In America, the poorest Americans today, people living under the poverty line, the vast majority of them have a cell phone, running water, toilets, electricity, a car, a television. These are things that 100 years ago, the richest people on Earth didn't have access to. So my point in all this is the present is a hell of a lot better than most people actually kind of think, first of all. The second thing, that to get back to your point, is why do we kind of live in this doom and gloom? Where's this pessimism coming from? And the funny thing is it's sort of hardwired into our brains. Every second, our senses just bombard us with data, right? The brain takes in massive amounts of data, and the first stop that all this data makes is kind of an ancient sliver of the temporal lobe called the amygdala. The amygdala is your danger detector, and it was really, really, really critical in an era where danger was of the tiger in the bush variety. You could die at any moment. It was great to have this kind of filtering. But today, we don't live in that world. Things have changed a bit, but still, we're taking in all this information, and the very first thing that happens, it goes to the part of the brain that is hardwired to look for danger. And most everything else doesn't get through. Now, this is worse in today's media world, where 500 cable channels, endless internet media, on and on, everybody's competing for your attention. And the old newspaper saw, if it bleeds, it leads, dominates, and that dominates because the amygdala is in control. On top of that, you know, making matters worse, we have a whole bunch of cognitive processing shortcuts that when they work, we call them heuristics. And when they fail, as Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman pointed out, we call them cognitive biases. A lot of our cognitive...
Give us an example. Like, what are you talking about?
A very simple cognitive bias that conspires to keep us in a bad mood is our negativity bias, which is a tendency to give preferential treatment to negative information over positive information. Or loss aversion is another one. Loss aversion is what keeps us stuck in ruts. It's fear of change for the fact that whatever I have today, once you take it away, whatever's coming has to be worse. Who knows if it's going to be worse or better, but loss aversion keeps us that way. Or confirmation bias, which on its own might not be so bad. It's a tendency to take in information and believe information that confirms our suspicions and to ignore everything else. By itself, maybe not so much of a problem, but in a world where if it bleeds, it leads, and we're being saturated with negative information all the time, having a confirmation bias, you know, can turn out to be deadly. But when you start blending these things together, what you quickly figure out is you've got a brain that has us believing we're living in a state of siege, and there's not a damn thing we can do about it.
Well, we may be living... I mean, I don't want to underplay the reality of, for example, climate change. When the methane starts bubbling out of the permafrost because the permafrost has melted and the amount of greenhouse gas in the air comes into, you know, in the ground comes into the air, that's a pretty dangerous state of affairs. And it's not because of the amygdala. I mean, that's what
I'm not saying that these things aren't real. And again, these are climate change, species die off. These are water shortages, energy shortages. These are very real, serious problems. Our point is that when you start adding these things up, the what's going on in the brain, you do find out, you know, we're more pessimistic than optimistic. And the reason this matters so much is it's almost impossible to work for a solution if you don't think it's possible.
And so when you talk about working for a solution, in your book, there are so many people doing these things which some of us have never heard of, and these kinds of medical technologies and information technologies and solar and water and all of these things. What is the role of the ordinary American who might be listening to this program, who, you know, probably isn't a do-it-yourself for solving virus vaccination problems in their garage?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, my question is, why not? Why aren't they doing this in their garage? I mean, these exponentially growing technologies,
they don't want to. They want to be with their families. They want to walk. I'll speak for myself. I don't want to do that stuff. I want to do a radio show. I want to walk my dogs. I want to be with my family. This thing of being an inventor, that's not for most of us, honestly.
Oh, I'm not saying it's for most of us or not, but I am saying that I think there's a bunch of different answers. I mean, this book is not a how-to book. If you want to, you know, invent your future, you are empowered today like never, ever, ever before. But the point is, these exponential growth curves are real. These technologies are coming. This is our future, and awareness matters. Knowing where we're going and knowing what's coming for us helps us be more nimble and active. And the point of abundance is, you know, we're not saying these things are automatic. This is not a techno-utopianist home. We don't believe that just because these neat technologies are coming, the world is going to get better. What we believe is that people can cooperate like never before thanks to these technologies, and we can cooperate our way towards, you know, abundance is us is a phrase that a friend of mine has coined recently, and I kind of like it. I think that's the point. We can take matters into our own hands right now for the first time ever. We can raise global standards of living over the next 20, 30 years if we want to. We have the power for the very first time to really, really, really dent these problems. That's an awareness that's critical. What you want to do with it, it's up to you.
The thing that I kept on coming across while I was reading this and thinking about it was the reality, and maybe this is coming from a negative mindset, but I don't think so. From my observation, whenever any cool new thing comes up, somebody tries to suppress it, co-opt it, buy it, monetize it, make a profit off of it, make you go through the toll booth, so to speak, before you can use it. In other words, or it becomes the purview of one group used to oppress another group, things like that.
Those very true statements, but you know, there's a really reproductive technology, for example, IVF. These were technologies that when they were first introduced 30 years ago, everybody was jumping up and down saying, oh my God, these are technologies that only the rich can afford, and you know, it's going to tilt the class situation and blah, blah, blah. And it turns out, no, 30 years later, these things are ubiquitous. Poor people, rich people, people the globe over are using these technologies to have children. So there is a diffusion rate. William Gibson said, you know, the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed. And I think that's what you're seeing. But one of the things that's happening because of the nature of these technologies and because of our delivery devices, our cell phones and our computers and our internet, they can't. You can't box it off and wall it off the way you once could. I mean, a lot of the things that you're talking about in terms of, you know, kind of it staying balkanized and out of the hands of the masses, well, that era is coming to a close. I mean, by the way, there's a whole new set of problems, right? Synthetic biology opens up amazing frontiers, but suddenly, you know, anybody in their basement can create a bioweapon. So there's a tremendous amount of power, but, you know, to borrow a phrase from Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility, right?
One thing that we haven't talked about is energy, and that's a very important thing. If you have truly abundant energy for an affordable price, or like solar energy, perhaps close to free if it's used correctly, then a lot of our other problems are solved. How do you see our energy future?
Well, I see a lot.
Well, we did talk about solar in India.
Talk about solar in India, and solar is a large part of the story, and most people don't realize that. You know, within 18 years, without any new technology on, just using current rates of growth, we can get all of our energy from solar, right? It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's, you know, massive. I think it's every 88 minutes enough solar energy falls on the Earth to power us for a year. That's a tremendous amount of energy. But, I mean, there's also, you know, wind power is also on an exponential growth curve. It's doing really cool stuff. There's fourth generation nuclear, which has none of the issues of first, second, or third generation nuclear that very few people have heard about. It's really not, you know, well known, but astounding technology. There's also, you know, the Internet of Things is coming, which is, you know, it's not an energy technology, but it basically means that all of our appliances become smart appliances. They turn themselves off when we're not using them. It saves us massive amount of energy everywhere kind of along the grid.
There is, I think by all accounts, a pretty limited time frame if we want to solve our big, huge problems without having major wars, plagues, famines, die-offs, and things like that. Now, in order, and you're talking about some amazing technologies and ways of thinking that will help us do that, do governments need to sign on? I mean, we see that governments tend to move at the speed of, what, small, decrepit snails or something, as opposed to the speed of even sound?
Yeah, I mean, I think, it's a very fair point, and I'm not saying that government doesn't have a role here, but one thing that's pretty clear is government isn't designed to keep up. They can't, no government in the world can proceed at an exponential rate of growth. And I think one of the reasons we're seeing as many problems as we're seeing right now is we're in a transition time. And the government doesn't know how to react. But what I think all of these things mean is that for the first time in history, we don't actually have to wait for the government to solve our problems. We don't have to wait for large corporations to solve our problems. We can solve our own problems ourselves. And that's what's new.
Your website is abundancethebook.com.
Abundancethebook.com or stephencotler.com.
Stephen Kotler, K-O-T-L-E-R. And people can, well, first of all, go get the book and also find out more about it on the website. And I'd like to congratulate you because this book, the second it came out, went to, what, number one on Amazon very quickly?
Yeah, it was, I think, the day we debuted at number one on Amazon and number one at Barnes & Noble, and then we hit the New York Times bestseller list at number two.
Well, fascinating and very important information. Stephen Kotler, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.